Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's call in his speech to the United Nations for the world to join together to fight Islamic State militants as he vowed to dismantle this network of death. We'll examine the daunting challenges and contradictions that expanding the war against ISIL to Syria pose with David Lesh, a specialist on Syria, whose latest book is Syria, The Fall of Assad? And analyze the conventional wisdom that by bombing ISIL, the US is helping Assad, who is now free to turn his guns on the moderate Syrian opposition the US supports and plans to invest $500 million in to build up its fighting capacity. Then we will speak with veteran journalist William Grider, the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, where he has his latest article, Obama's Long War in the Middle East. We will discuss the orchestrated campaign to paint Obama as a weakling to force his hand into intervening once more in Iraq, and the extent to which modern American warfare has become a video game for the media to feed on, as well as William Grider's contention that we are in danger of becoming deranged by our own militarism. Then finally, we'll examine the incriminating documents uncovered by CREW, the Center for Responsible Ethics in Washington, that reveal secret GOP records of corporate donors paying for access to Republican governors, with one document listing 17 major corporate members of the Republican Governors Association's secretive 501c4 that had previously shielded the identities of donations by major American corporations in an A to Z of America's largest corporations from Aetna to Walmart. Sheila Krumholz, the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the contents of the documents and their likely impact. And joining us now is Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And the contradictions and the challenges that I mentioned in the opening and the conventional wisdom that bombing the Islamic State in Syria helps Assad, who's now free to turn his guns on the moderate Syrian opposition that we are supporting and plan to invest $500 million more in to build up its fighting capacity. You've met with Assad. Everybody's saying that he's just thrilled with what's happening. I'm not entirely sure that his position is that as secure and as benefiting as much as people are saying. What's your reading on it?
Well, I think probably both answers are correct. I think in the short term, this does probably help Assad in the sense that his forces, when they did confront ISIS, particularly in the last few months, they didn't fare all too well. So they weren't basically the core forces of the Syrian army, but still it was draining. And Assad was coming under some criticism even from his own support base in and outside of Damascus and within the Alawite community. For engaging in policies that, although the rise of ISIS gave reality to the consistent narrative of the regime ever since the beginning of the crisis, that that the extremist Muslims were behind this from the very beginning and injecting instability into Syria, he might have gotten a little bit more than what he wished for, because ISIS turned out to be something, I think, bigger and better than they had ever envisioned. In the long term, though, Ian, I think that what you said might be correct, in the sense that ISIS had turned their weapons on other Syrian opposition groups as much as they had against the regime. In fact, I think in the upcoming, if not for these strikes, there was going to be a very important battle for Aleppo, the important city in northern Syria. That was being fought between regime forces, non-ISIS opposition groups, and ISIS. And so the fact that ISIS may now have to worry about U.S. and coalition forces and bombs being dropped on them and perhaps maybe contained or pushed back somewhat in Syria, this actually over the long term may free up some non-ISIS Syrian opposition groups do what they have always wanted to do, and which is their first priority, and that is aim their guns at the regime in Damascus, not at ISIS.
And what about a third possibility? It would seem to me that the best way to get rid of ISIS would be for the Alawites and the Christians who and the constituency that supports Assad to basically get rid of Assad, assuming that's possible, because he has brought them nothing but grief. And the fact that foreign air forces are flying at will over his country does make him look impotent. And I'm just wondering whether in his recent address to both the United States and to the United Nations, President Obama might have said, address the Syrian people under Assad directly and just saying, you know, we want to get rid of ISIS, but we also want to get rid of your leader who's brought about this disaster. Because if you could turn the Syrian army against ISIS, you know, and if Assad were to go, wouldn't that solve so much of the country's problems?
Well, it would. But how do we get there? And that's the big question. And I don't think the Alawites or Christians who have stood by the regime are going to run away anytime soon. Even though, as I said earlier, there's been some expression of dissatisfaction with Assad and the leadership over the course of the war, the length of the war, and destruction of the war itself. I think what might occur, and perhaps what the U.S. is hoping for, is that with this international coalition, perhaps with an agreement with Iran over the nuclear issue by November 24th, that there could be some level of cooperation or understanding between the U.S., Iran, perhaps even Russia, to use their influence in Damascus to compel Assad to move aside, or some sort of enter into some sort of agreement regarding a transition. And of course, some of these agreements were bandied about early on in the uprising, and Assad, of course, steadfastly refused them. That's, I think, what the ideal situation from a U.S. standpoint is, that now that they are supporting the non-ISIS Syrian opposition with financial support, weapons, and training, although it will take a good deal of time before that is activated, at least a year probably, before it becomes really a force to be reckoned with, and plus the pressure from ISIS, because we're not going to eliminate that threat by any means, just simply through the air, that perhaps some sort of political solution, which is the only way to really undermine ISIS, because it's a symptom of two failed states. It's a symptom of regional international players projecting their own agendas into those two failed states. And the only way to eliminate the threat of any sort of radical groups such as ISIS from coming up or reemerging is some sort of return to stability and security in both Iraq and Syria. But that's a long, long-term project in both countries, in my mind.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad Question. So what do you understand, though, is going on with the Alawites in terms of the casualties they're taking, because they took some heavy casualties when the airport that fell recently in Raqqa, an important air base, and the Islamic State literally took all of the Syrian army captives out to the desert and shot them, and they also beheaded a lot of them and ran around holding up these severed heads. And I'm wondering whether that message ever gets back to the families of these soldiers who, surely mothers and parents must be concerned about sending their sons off to fight. And the more that the Alawite minority suffers casualties, the less of a pool that he's got left. And I'm not sure that Hezbollah can fill the gap, but so how much are they facing a manpower crisis over the long haul? And this war seems to have gone on for 3 years in any case.
Well, they are facing a manpower crisis, and particularly, as we know, ISIS is very adept at utilizing social media. And so, especially amongst many of the young and their families who despite any sort of government restrictions, have access to social media instruments in areas under Assad and those that have been supporting Assad, this has been raising some questions, and there have been some disturbances in the last few weeks since ISIS has scored some victories against Syrian troops. And there have been some voices of dissent and opposition that are quickly muzzled by the regime, as they're so adept at doing. But, you know, this has been ongoing for some time because the Alawites have lost a lot of people. I mean, some, you know, say 60, 70,000 at the very least. And then, of course, all of the destruction. And the problem is, I think, in trying to separate Alawites from the regime, that it probably could have been more easily done before the uprising itself, because there were a number of Alawites that weren't too happy with the Alawites in power because, you know, they didn't really enjoy the benefits of being Alawite. And it was, and they were, the benefits seemed to be focused on a small group of Alawites at the top who were, you know, among the Assad family members and those associated with them. Since the uprising began and since the narrative has become reality in terms of extremist Sunni Muslims, you know, dead set upon killing Shiites and Alawites and Christians and so forth. Many Alawites who perhaps before the uprising were dead set against Assad realize now they have no choice. It's not so much that many Alawites like Assad or like the regime, but they feel there's just no other alternative. And one of the shortcomings, I think, of the Sunni-dominated Syrian opposition over the last few years is that they never really reached out in a significant way, mostly because they were backed by such stronghold Sunni regimes in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. They didn't reach out to the Alawites and Christians to try to include them in a broad-based opposition movement that maybe could have drawn some Alawites away. Knowing now that their fate is either support Assad or massacre, they have steadfastly supported the Assad regime, even though, again, as I said, many personally dislike the Assad regime or hold the Assad regime responsible or partly responsible for bringing about the utter destruction of the country.
Well, that's why I think speaking with Henri Bakke yesterday, who made that point, that he felt that the President Obama should acknowledge, reach out to the Alawites and the Christians, and basically say, you know, we're on your side. We're ready to get rid of these other guys, but we're not going to do it as long as the person who's caused this war is around. And my understanding is, furthermore, that Assad has been very cynically not targeting the Islamic State and even Jabhat al-Nusra for the longest time. He's been turning his guns on the Free Syrian Army and the moderate opposition. And more recently, he was sort of shamed into taking on the Islamic State because of all of the international coverage of them and their growing strength. So is the conventional wisdom? I saw Mike Morrell, the former CIA deputy director, on CBS last night saying, oh, Assad's just got to be as pleased as pink about what's happening. And then he's going to turn his guns on the Free Syrian Army. Is there any evidence that that's what he's going to do?
Yeah, I mean, he, for him and his supporters, I think the biggest existential threat is to the regime itself is not so much ISIS, but, you know, the non-ISIS Syrian opposition supported by Western powers. You know, they've always figured that that's the combination that could eliminate the regime. And so,
but why is that, David? Is that because they're the most authentic opposition? Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I think you know, in terms of ideology, you know, the so-called moderate opposition, over many, although many are Salafist and very conservative Sunni Muslim, you know, many are calling for, you know, continuance of a secular state and in some way, or to protect minorities, or, you know, some level of democracy. Now, maybe more in terms, they may be saying this in terms of baiting, you know, Western support. You know, that's the direction, the most threatening direction, I think, from the point of view of the of the regime, whereas ISIS, they're transnational. Many are foreigners. The other, you know, non-ISIS Syrian opposition, they're Syrian nationalists. So they see them, I think they've always seen them as much more threatening. And so that's why they've turned their guns, I think, more on them, in addition to the fact that, you know, the fact that ISIS, the growth of ISIS, has tended to confirm the narrative that I mentioned earlier, the Assad regime from the beginning, and tends to place the regime from their perspective, as they would love to be placed, on the side of the international coalition, that they too are fighting, you know, radical Sunni extremism, as exemplified by ISIS. Now, you know, the international coalition is saying, no, that's not going to work. That play is not going to work. But they've already, I think, had some unofficial intelligence cooperation and even some official correspondence. And the regime is going to play this up as much as possible. And the regime is going to, you know, is going to portray themselves as almost being a quasi member of the coalition.
Well, they've already done that in suggesting that they were gave permission to these recent airstrikes, which apparently they were told they were going to happen, but that was about it.
Right, exactly.
So, given this paradox that we keep talking about supporting the Free Syrian Army and the moderate opposition, and now the president's asked for another $500 million to train them and arm them, what are we going to do about what we've just been talking about? If by bombing ISIS you free up Assad to attack the Free Syrian Army, what are we going to do about protecting them if we're planning on building them up and giving them $500 million? I mean, it seems that there's a missing element to this here somewhere.
Well, there is, and that's a little bit too little, too late type of thing. As I said earlier, bombing ISIS and containing him, it perhaps may free up Assad, but it also may free up the non-ISIS opposition, who have one eye on ISIS and one eye on the regime. Even as fractured and fluid as the Syrian opposition is, I don't think that the Assad regime can eliminate them totally. As I said, there's, I think, an important battle for Aleppo coming up, and the Syrian opposition, has been losing some ground. And if they lose Aleppo, that could be quite debilitating to the Syrian opposition, armed opposition in general. And it's almost like a race against time for the Assad regime. Can they, defeat or eliminate the Syrian opposition enough before real U.S. support becomes manifest and before it becomes, something that can threaten the regime itself? On the other hand, as we were talking earlier, I mean, the Syrian regime, they are losing manpower. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the money to extend control over the country, anything close to what they had, obviously, before the crisis, much less the credibility and legitimacy to do so. So I think it's in their interest to come to some sort of a political settlement, but they want to do so, of course, in a way that's most advantageous to them, and at a time when perhaps they are militarily on the uptick. So it's very complicated. It's very murky right now because we have these multiple fronts. But I don't think ISIS is going to be eliminated in any sense. They may be contained, maybe somewhat degraded, but they're still going to continue to be a player unless some more force, particularly boots on the ground, are added to the equation.
But let me just make a suggestion here, which is, I'm certainly not an armchair warrior and don't wish to be one, but what if the U.S. started some psyops? They're flying their planes over there anyway to bomb ISIS over, and the cruise missiles that were fired at the Khorasan group, they were fired from the Mediterranean, I understand, and went across Assad's Alawite territory. If the U.S. made a kind of propaganda outreach with dropping leaflets or whatever you do in the modern age to tell the Syrian people supporting Assad that they would like them to be a part of a secular world and be brought back into the world of nations and civilized nations at that, and that they would like to work with the Alawites and the Christian minorities to protect them, to eliminate this, what the president calls cancer, the Islamic State. Is there any way that that could work? I mean, as you say, boots on the ground are the only ones that can get rid of the Islamic State. So if you manage to get rid of the Assads, who are just too much, too incendiary, and if you could then ally them with the Free Syrian Army and the other opposition groups, not, you know, short of the ones that want Sharia law and the ISIS people who want this caliphate, could that work?
I would submit to you, Ian, that nothing would solidify support amongst Assad's base for him than the U.S. going in and dropping leaflets or, you know, sending in internet messages to come join the U.S. because such is the paranoia and suspicion of U.S. designs and manipulation, and plus there's also the experience of Iraq, where the U.S. Did that same very thing and promised this and that to a number of parties and didn't follow through, and then we had with the Sunni awakening, promising that there would be an inclusive government, and that didn't happen. So right, the U.S. just doesn't have much credibility right now in terms of trying to convince people to, leave the situation you're in, abandon Assad and join, the coalition and overthrow Assad or anything like that. So I don't think that'll work at this time.
Well, excuse my naivety. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, and you mentioned the awakening. I mean, here we are selling out the very Sunnis that are the ones that saved George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's Iraq misadventure through the surge. And, my understanding is from my friend Bob Baer, the former CIA officer, he said that the Sunni tribes have been contacting him and saying, we want to come to Washington, and we're the only guys that can get rid of the Islamic State. We're there on the ground, but we want guarantees that we're not going to be slaughtered by the Baghdad government that they despise, and for good reasons.
Yeah, I mean, for people in the region itself, unfortunately not for the first time, they look out and see U.S. policy, and they're tremendously confused because it seems like in one country we're supporting one group, in another country we're supporting other groups that are against the first group. So it's a mismatch, a crisscrossing policies that are very confusing to the people in the region themselves, and tends to reinforce the paranoia and suspicions and enhances the actual capabilities of the U.S. to manipulate these things. But it makes it difficult now based on what happened in Iraq, the fact that, we have not, certainly from the Syrian opposition point of view, been as supportive to them as they feel we should have been all along. So the U.S. just really doesn't have much credibility with many groups in Iraq and Syria. And this will make it harder, unfortunately, to try to craft political settlements in either country. In any event, it's going to take, I think, a long time to build a real stable and inclusive government in Iraq and to bring about any sort of political settlement in Syria between the multiple groups that exist there.
Well, David Lesh, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesh. He's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States from Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad Question. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Obama's long war in the Middle East.
Yeah,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Grider, who's the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and the author of the national bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Who Will Tell the People, and Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. A reporter for 40 years, he has written for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 frontline documentaries on PBS. And his latest book is Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And his latest article at The Nation is Obama's Long War in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Grider.
Yes, thank you.
And there is a tradition, or at least a history, of American presidents who have not served in the military being seduced or co-opted or becoming infatuated with...
Or intimidated, I would say.
Yeah, I suppose intimidated too. You know, Ronald Reagan was in the war in movies, but he would tear up every time the Marine Band played. Just about all of the presidents since then, of course Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, as we know, avoided military service. Eisenhower knew the military, knew the games they played, tried to rein in the military-industrial complex, and even made a stinging rebuke of them in his farewell address. So is Obama's use of the military, do you think, a part of that tradition, if you will, of presidents not having served in the military being rolled?
I think in Obama's case it's a bit more complicated. That's the headline, certainly. He has surrendered to the pressures which have driven the both governing elites but also the country at large into bad choice wars. And we've now had a string of them, really going back to Vietnam 50 years ago or Korea before that. Obama, I give him more credit for sincerity than many of his critics and even his one-time supporters who are now disillusioned with him. And that is, I think it's clear he sincerely thought that he could somehow gradually wean the U.S. government off of its reflexes, that is, war-making reflexes, and that he would do this by just being a more reasonable guy and trying to keep everybody calm and so forth, and preaching a bit that these wars, which he of course had opposed in Iraq and rather strongly, these wars are counterproductive. The world is facing bigger challenges like climate and so forth that are not subject to war as solutions. And he got some good luck in that process, and then he got some bad luck. And I don't want to go on forever here, but I have a different understanding of his failures as president, and that is it's in his character, first of all, that he really, I think, sincerely believed that he was above the usual partisan fraction and fighting, and he could help bring the opposing sides together by being rational and reasonable, et cetera, et cetera. And that he's not very good at that, to put it mildly, but also he had opposition that was vicious from the start and refused to acknowledge his powers, usual powers as president. And my explanation, which will offend a lot of people perhaps, but I believe it's true, he faced a unique disability as president because he is a black man. And Republicans groan when they hear somebody say that, but I think it's true. And not all Republicans, but a good many Republicans, and especially the leaders of the Republican Party, from the beginning, his first day in office, took advantage of that. And they're obviously wise enough not to say, hey, he's a black man, we don't want a black president. But nevertheless, they played off those buried emotions among Americans, particularly in the American South, where the white politicians and many of the white voters, if not all of them, are still not reconciled to racial integration, even though the country as a whole has moved way beyond that. I will stop on that, but that your headline is still correct. He was rolled by all of the forces of military power and by events into succumbing to their reflexes.
So just going forward to the present then, William Grider, what explains how he got buffaloed into this latest war, shall we call it Iraq III? It seems as if, just in terms of proportionality, 3,000 people died at 9/11, the Al-Qaeda attacked the financial center in Wall Street, the military center at the Pentagon, and almost got the Capitol. And that obviously riled up the United States. But this latest war appears to have been provoked by the beheading of two Americans. So I don't get the proportionality, and it does seem to me that over the last months or so, there's been a steady drumbeat, and I'm not sure where it came from, and mostly in the press, but it's being generated by obviously elsewhere, that this guy is weak, he's feckless, he's not standing up for America, and we've got to do something. Who's behind that? It seems orchestrated to me.
Well, nothing happens without orchestra in American politics, you know that. Right. But I wish I had a quick, simple explanation. But I've been in Washington, as you know, for half a century virtually as a reporter and observer, and I have a certain sophistication in reading events. And even I was sort of taken aback by the quickness of the, particularly starting with the press and the pundits and so forth, but really swallowing up public dialogue because of the beheadings. And the best I can get is, yes, of course, the hawks. We have two senators, McCain from Arizona and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. And they are absolutely broken records. They want to go to war. They want to go to war. We must go to war. Obama's too cowardly, blah, blah, blah. So they were, to the extent somebody was trying to manipulate it, they and lined up, I would say, corporate interests of a certain kind, the American Enterprise Institute being one leading example, and the Heritage Foundation and some others are always for going to war in the right, you know, provocative circumstances. But I think the explanation I reach for is the stupidity of American reflexes. And underneath that, a reluctance to face the modern reality and condition of our country in the world. I'll try to summarize this quickly. We know, from those of us who know the history, recognize that going to war is a sort of repeating reflex in American history, sometimes profoundly necessary and well justified, as in World War II, and other times just coming out of a sense of we're supposed to do this, or we get to do this, or we just too ignorant of the circumstances to stop and wait and ask some questions before we start shooting. This venture now came out of those reflexes, I think, and here's the dilemma we are in now, I believe, and it's epic. And it will take years to resolve, and it's very dangerous for the country. When the Cold War ended 25 years ago, American leaders from both parties, but Bill Clinton was president, and he and others of his administration quickly embraced the idea that now the U.S. was the last standing superpower, and it would supervise the world. And out of that, the government started deploying lots of troops around the country, not in huge numbers, but sort of setting up outposts in a lot of countries, which essentially we didn't give a damn about one way or another. They were in Africa or Asia and other places. And those were, in my view, tripwires, sort of warning lines. And if bad guys somewhere cross those lines or provoke something, we would be there with our military power to snuff it out or intimidate them into behaving and so forth and so on. That era is over. That policy, the so-called unipolar world, which we were supposedly operating and managing, was always nonsense, but it is now visibly nonsense. And yet, the U.S. government clings to it, and they cling to it because they don't know what else to do. So I'm saying this for Americans who are not deeply married to this we are number one and we'll always be number one notion of the world, because we've got to get out of this. If we stay in this, as this recent last war illustrates, the country is going to be deranged by our militarism. And I will stop on that, but that's what makes me so alarmed now, that we're in a new condition, and the people in power in this country, and I say both parties, and the military are prisoners of their own making.
Now, it does seem, though, William Grider, that the war has become a kind of what the Romans called bread and circuses. And furthermore, it's sanitized. It's like a video game. You see all of these high-tech weapons blowing up buildings on television. And that seems to sort of satisfy the kind of world of infotainment that's taken over from news. And it also doesn't particularly involve boots on the ground. And I notice in this latest war, or at least these strikes against Syria, that the Pentagon was able to show off this ridiculous F-22 flying turkey, along with the latest flying turkey, the F-35, that the American taxpayer spent hundreds of billions of dollars on to justify it. So,
and I would add, a lot of it was made in California, was it not?
Well, yeah, the California used to be the head of the military-industrial complex, but the Georgians and the Texans have pretty much moved it because of the Republican control of the Congress. But nevertheless, the military-industrial complex is ubiquitous. It's in every congressional district. That's what Eisenhower originally was saying in his speech. He wanted to call it the military-industrial congressional complex, but he was advised to take it out in deference to the Congress.
You know,
so that's the way it works, don't you think? But just in terms of what we're seeing on television now, the way this war is being presented, it's sort of an entertainment, isn't it?
I got an email from my son-in-law who lives in New York and has a sort of droll sense of events, and he was talking about something I had written. And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, I have to go. We've got Syria bombing on TV tonight." That's exactly what he was expressing in a bitter tone, that this is what Americans get now with their television and other forms of entertainment. I think I'm probably more sympathetic to Americans at large than they deserve at this moment, because the fact is they always rally around the flag at first, and then, and partly because they're not getting the truth from the big media. And then with time, as the body bags start coming home with Americans in them, they get to the facts, and then they turn against the war. And now I think Americans, because we've been at war now for, 20 years, they're kind of resigned rather than eager. And the other group that's trapped are the people who are in the uniform military. I'm talking about those men and women who were, you know, good soldiers. They get the call, they will go. They don't have any choice, really, but that always begins again with resolution and turns bitter and just deranged, frankly, for a lot of young people who were in uniform.
Well, of course, we have the, in many ways, the idea of body bags changing public opinion. Curiously enough, it's the reverse is happening in Russia, where Putin has managed to hide the body bags coming back from Ukraine, and any reporter that tries to dig into it gets beaten up by KGB thugs. But there was a demonstration last weekend in the streets of Moscow. 30,000 people turned up, which is pretty brave, protesting that war. But that war is totally unnecessary because, in large part, the West pushed Putin into that.
Absolutely.
By their stupid movement of NATO eastward and not recognizing Russia's national interests. So I wanted to get your response to this confusion, William Grider. Here we are bombing the Islamic State in Syria, who are fighting Assad, who's an ally of Russia. Yet Russia's incredibly concerned about the Islamic State because of the Caucasus. At the same time, we're in a situation with Russia where we have so damaged the relationship with Russia that they're not going to work with us. So, and of course, in the United Nations speech that the president made, he, on the one hand, talked about how we're going to root out the Islamic State no matter how long it takes. And then at the same time, he castigated Russia for breaking international law. And frankly, just in terms of legality, this war that he's just getting into in bombing Syria is extremely dubious in its legality. There has been no UN resolution authorizing force. It is not a part of a NATO operation, and there's no Arab League resolution in favor of military action, and no congressional authorization for war. So go figure.
Well, we've had arguments in this country, and I've participated in them for literally at least 40 years about the unconstitutionality of presidents taking us into wars one after another. And at the same time, I mean, I'm happy to call for a regular order with the Constitution, but the fact is that's gone. Coming out of World War II, I know that history because I was a boy at the time. Coming out of World War II, the U.S. really led the peace in a powerfully creative way. It decided not to punish the losers, punish some of them by hanging the Gestapo officers and so forth, but it basically helped those countries, Germany, Japan, and some others, to get back on their feet and restart the global economy, et cetera, et cetera. Then it evolved into this powerful nation in the Cold War rivalry. Then the Cold War ends, and some of us hoped, unreasonably, that we would then settle down and back off of our superpower engine, the war machine, and begin to work out new relations around the world. On the contrary, this was a Clinton administration, but fully supported by the Republican Party. We pushed people around, kept pushing them around, and waded into other people's fights, I think ignorant more than imperious. And that's the danger we're now facing as a country. And the rest of the world, not everybody, of course, but mostly, they understand that the U.S. is not what it used to be. It's in a weakened condition economically. It is stretched way too thin in terms of its power relations. And quite stupidly, this was done by George W. Bush, of course, not Obama, not Clinton, but nevertheless, most politicians rallied round and said, oh, yes, we got to go invade Iraq. And we wandered into the middle of this almost ancient separation and division within Islam, Shia and Sunni, without even knowing what it was about. And for the most part, Americans still don't know what it's about. I mean, it's a class division. It's a whole, it's a cultural, it's dynasties versus little republics, and military dictators and so forth and so on. And the idea that a great nation would just say, well, we're going to put a stop to that. Let's take out their government and we'll put a new government in its place.
Right. And we've been taking out secular Arab leaders ever since with Gaddafi and trying to get Assad. And well, they're always replaced by Islamic fanatics, so go figure. A last quick second here.
Well, Americans need to get sober on this real fast, and I really do. I don't usually talk this way, but I worry for the country because people still are not getting the truth from their elected governors or the big media, and they don't realize that they are digging this hole deeper for all of us, not to mention the world at large. And I think, to put it crudely, if we go over there with our F-22s, F-35s, whatever, or long-range missiles fired from boats, ships, the people on the other end whose village has been bombed do not forget that. And I think Americans are sufficiently naive. They believe, as you would expect, the usual propaganda about how we are good and other people are bad. They don't realize we are sowing this problem for our future generations all over the place we've never heard about. So I shudder at the weakness of our position, and I hope that our politics at home, you won't get it from the Republican Party, you won't get it from the Democratic Party, albeit there are some good folks in both. But we got to get out of this, and I don't know how to get out of it except for people like you and me shouting and ranting about it, but also people at large saying, well, let's try to make sense of this. This is crazy what we're doing. We keep going to war, and the results keep getting worse. What's wrong with that picture?
And we haven't won a war since World War II. So I thank you for joining us, William Grider.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with William Grider, who's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of the national bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Who Will Tell the People, and Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. A reporter for 40 years, he has written for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 Frontline documentaries on PBS. And his latest book is Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And his latest article at The Nation is Obama's Long War in the Middle East. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about secret GOP records of corporate donors who pay for access to Republican governors.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them, Bobo Nyan, yeah. War is not the answer. I want to know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. Let the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. I want to know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sheila Krumholz, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She first joined the Center for Responsive Politics in 1989, serving as assistant editor of the very first edition of Open Secrets, the center's flagship publication. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Krumholz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And this revelation by CRU, the Center for Responsible Ethics in Washington, D.C., that reveals secret GOP records of corporate donors paying for access to Republican governors. One of the documents lists 17 major corporate members of the Republican Governors Association secretive 501c4 that had previously shielded the identities of donations. And these involve major American corporations in what is an A to Z of America's largest corporations, from Aetna to Walmart. So this really seems to me to strike at the heart of the 501c4 racket, if you will, because it's so obvious that these big corporations enjoy the anonymity. And it's also tax exempt. That's the extraordinary part of it.
Yes, I think this gives lie to the notion that these are truly social welfare organizations, which are organized to contemplate policies which benefit the broader public and social welfare for all. So these are arms of political organizations providing secret cover for certain activities of these organizations, cover which is valuable both to the organizations and to the politicians that want to attend their events, their lavish resorts and junkets.
And in this case, the documents pertain to a Republican Governors Association meeting at the La Costa Resort and Spa in Carlsbad, California. And again, companies like Aetna, WellPoint, American Southern Company, utility companies. It's actually a pretty extraordinary list. Big lobbying firms in Washington, Dutco, Grayling, the BGR Group, WellPoint, Anthem, Blue Cross, the Southern Company, and Edison. Big energy companies, Coke, of course, National Rifle Association, Business Roundtable, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, and Hewlett-Packard. Here they are all giving money to the Republican governors through an arm of the Republican Governors Association called a tax-exempt 501c4 Republican Governors Public Policy Committee. So I guess you can't blame these guys. I mean, wasn't it true in corporate America that you were CEOs were a little bit skittish about giving money to politicians, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, particularly if they're in the business of creating consumer goods, because half of their customers are Republicans and half of their customers are Democrats.
Well, absolutely. That's why they want to give to these nonprofit groups, which need not disclose, which are not required to disclose their donors, so they can have their cake and eat it too. They can curry favor with politicians, gain access, again, particularly at these very at these luxury resorts and lavish events where you know, spending time with a member is very different from when you're trying to buttonhole somebody in the corridors of the Capitol, whether it's a state capitol or Washington. So this is very lucrative. It's a lucrative opportunity for these companies and their lobbyists, which in some cases might be prohibited from undertaking these activities if they were to reveal who's footing the bill, who's attending. And so there's not only it's not just that they're abusing in this case the tax exempt status of their organizations by pretending to be a non-political group but actively pursuing a political agenda, but they're also perhaps bending the rules at the state and national level.
So what's your understanding of how these documents were revealed? Obviously, they were secret, and they certainly didn't want to reveal them. But my understanding is that some simple coding mistake laid these documents bare to the public. Obviously, somehow the crew managed to, what did they do, hack into it, or was it simply a mistake on the part of the Republicans Governors Association, or did the Center for Responsible Ethics in Washington do some hacking or something? I don't know. Do you know?
Yes. Well, I'm not exactly sure how Crew obtained the documents. The Republican Governors Association says that it was a password-protected right. Password protected site, so they you know, should not have had access. But the truth is, and I've seen this time and again, that particularly in this kind of Wild West age we live in on the internet, nothing is truly you know, completely secure. It's very difficult to secure information, and even when you think that it is airtight and locked down and behind a firewall, there are so many ways for information to get out, and that's why we've seen inadvertent releases, leaks of documents and information like this in the past. There was a very high-profile leak relating to the group Aetna, the insurance company, and they were responsible for having posted information and I think you know, quickly grabbed it and brought it down after it had been revealed that this was posted. But once it's out, you know, once the cat's out of the bag. So it's hard to really blame Crew for having sought information about these groups. I think their doing so is in the nature of their watchdog operations and work. I don't think it's untoward or, you know, It is the nature of these kinds of investigations about groups which are potentially involved in activities they shouldn't be involved in. So I think the best policy here is not to blame Crew for having somehow obtained this information, presuming they haven't broken any laws, but rather for organizations like the RGA and the DGA and other similar organizations that are kind of political and pretending to have operations which are not political, for them instead to be transparent about who they are, what they stand for, what the purpose of their organization really is, because it's really hard to feel too sorry for them once it's been revealed that they've been duplicitous.
Well, of course, the spokesperson for the a spokeswoman for the Republican Governors Association have blamed the messenger here. They've called Crew a group of partisan hypocrites because David Brock, the former conservative hitman who now runs Crew, has been working with Democrats. But my understanding is that Cruz's background is nonpartisan. So the messenger's being obviously being blamed here. But isn't at the heart of the problem here is just how our politics are awash with money and our politicians have been turned into telemarketers?
It's true. They are dialing for dollars and cannot get off the phone, can't get off the hamster wheel of fundraising because of the nature of politics, with being driven by kind of political consulting industry, especially, and the high cost of media in large media markets, and also because, and I'd say especially because of the influence of outside groups, which are ratcheting up the amount of money that any politician running for any significant race needs to have in their war chest in order to be able to fight fire with fire, to be able to counter any kind of 11th hour attack, which might come from any corner, from an unknown organization with an anodyne, patriotic-sounding name, and you have no idea really who's bankrolling the effort. So the secrecy, the sums of money which are now at play at all levels of government, I think, are far more concerning than whether or not Crew is finding out this information based purely on a nonpartisan basis or on with partisan motivations. I mean, Crew, again, it's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, I think, to its credit, has over the years done high-quality research, and it's targeted both high-profile Democrats and Republicans. So I think if it were only targeting Republicans, there would be more credence to the notion that this is just a hit job, but they're not historically an organization that has pulled its punches, as far as I could see. They've gone after politicians they label as corrupt on both sides of the aisle. They target people aggressively, but I think it remains to be seen whether that will change under the new leadership of David Brock. I don't think it's acted as merely a liberal front for Democrats before, and if it has, it hasn't been very reliable for them.
Sure. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Sheila Krumholz.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sheila Krumholz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.